nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, first of all, let me acknowledge, I mean, as any big project, it involves some key people, and I list them here. We call it extended family, actually. There are three professors, groups, which work in particularly close collaboration. It's Professor Evgeny Narimanov and Professor Alexandra Baltasova. And it's my pleasure to list these two absolutely critical participants of the team, Dr. Kildyshev, Alex Kildyshev, and Dr. Vlad Drachev, who are largely responsible for theoretical and experimental efforts in our work on metamaterials. It is an exciting project because it touches very much the fundamentals, the way light propagates and interacts with materials. And if you think of this, that light is, photons. With a photon, we have ultimate unit of information because with photons, we propagate information at the ultimate speed, which is the speed of light. And that's because we actually package information into signal of zero mass. However, materials interact with light kind of in a strange way, if I could put it this way, because out of the two field components of light, which is the electrical field components and magnetic field components, in the optical range, actually one field component really strongly couples to atoms, and that's the electrical field. The magnetic one remains largely unused. So you could say that light is kind of handicapped when it comes to the optical range. So out of its hands, it uses only one, the electrical hand, in quotes, to probe atoms. And metamaterials, which basically stands for artificial materials, because meta in Greek means beyond, implying that we create materials that have properties unattainable with those existing in nature. Metamaterials enable coupling, efficient coupling to both field components, the electrical and magnetic ones. And then, of course, enriches physics and enables a number of very interesting applications, which I outlined some of those. And when it comes down to this artificial magnetism, this is the textbook. People in theoretical physics would consider it's like a Bible, because this is Landau-Lifshitz's course of theoretical physics, probably the best book ever written on theoretical physics. And it's a quotation from there that for the optical spectral range, for high frequencies, there is no actually magnetic response. Therefore, you have to set mu, and mu is so-called magnetic permeability, which is responsible, which describes how strongly light couples to with its magnetic field component to materials. So it says that you should set it equal to one, which is same as in vacuum. In other words, there is no any interaction to, or let's say almost no interaction to materials at optical frequencies. And that's indeed true. There are no any materials in nature which would have any magnetic response at high frequencies. All those which we know well, ferromagnetics, paramagnetics, they of course have frequencies, resonant frequencies in microwave range or even low frequency range. And here I'm outlining the breakthrough in this area. In my opinion, it's quite spectacular. Only this should stay in history of science, because within like 5 years only, the magnetic, the frequency at which magnetic response occurs was increased by 5 orders of magnitude, because as I said, all materials in nature have the largest frequency at which this coupling occurs in the range of 10 gigahertz, with few exceptions when it goes to up to 100 gigahertz. So, and this is the milestones. That's the Berkeley group led by Shang Zhang. This is University of New Mexico led by Steve Brook. And this is our major competitor, Martin Wegener's group from Karlsruhe, Germany, where they created materials that have magnetic response at telecommunication wavelengths. And what we accomplished in our group, we demonstrated magnetic response, artificial magnetism across the entire visible spectral range. And the idea is actually Very, very straightforward. It's textbook-like idea. I guess any students could come up with this idea. So if you take a pair of metallic rods, such as those shown here, let's say silver or gold, because that's good materials, because they have very low losses in the optical range. And if light is incident perpendicular to this pair so that the magnetic field penetrates through the pair of these metallic rods separated by some dielectric, then because magnetic field varies in time, the magnetic flux going through this pair of rods also varies in time. And according to the Faraday's law, there should be some electromotive forces and current induced in this pair of rods. One could argue, wait a minute, you have here metallic rods, which of course do support conduction current, but how about the dielectric in between? And here we take the advantage of the fact that the so-called displacement current, which is also a very important term in the Maxwell's equation, increases with the frequency. And although it doesn't play much role at lower frequencies, at the optical range, the displacement current actually can play a dominant role. So you could think of this as kind of conduction current which occurs in the metallic rods is caused by the displacement current in dielectric. Or equally, you could thought of as just LC circuit with metals which have negative dielectric permittivity representing inductive element and dielectric in between with positive epsilon representing capacitance. So it works like LC circuit but at optical frequencies. Resonant LC circuit at optical frequencies. Moreover, you can control the frequency of this optical nanocircuit, which could be the basis for nanophotonics, things like that, by simply changing the size and the shape of these rods. Well, the next step is straightforward. So we could take not a single pair of rods, but a series of those, or just pair of metal strips, simply to enhance the response. And that's exactly what we did. You could see the structure which we fabricated here at Berkman Technology Center. So it consists of two silver strips. They are trapezoidal in shape just because of some peculiarities related to fabrication. It's not really that critical. And they are separated by a dielectric space. So here you could see all the sizes. Of course, they are nanometer scale, and it's extremely critical to keep all the sizes. This is AFM picture. This is field emission scanning electron microscope picture of the structure which we fabricated. Here is the modeling effort. In all this business of metamaterials, modeling plays indeed a very critical role. So you could see the side view. You see this is the bottom metal strip, and this is the top strip. So this is the side view. And with these arrows, I'm showing the displacement current. You could see that it circulates indeed. And what is important that in the upper and the bottom metal strips, current goes in opposite direction. So this anti-symmetric mode, which is excited by the magnetic field component, is responsible for the magnetic artificial magnetic response of this structure. And with the color, I'm showing here the magnetic field component. The incident light has magnetic field component 1, which corresponds to this color. And you see between the strips, it's actually enhanced. It's larger than 1, but moreover, it's negative, meaning that magnetic response here is negative so that the induced magnetic field looks against the incident field. And this is the optical range. So if you want to see how it varies in the time, of course, the magnetic field component flips up and down, but the field between the strips always looks against the magnetic field component of the incident light. So this is the artificial magnetism which can be created in this structure. And this is a wonderful picture, in my opinion, because arguably this is for the first time, at least those who didn't see my presentation before, you see colors which are largely because of the coupling of the magnetic field component to materials. As opposed to all the colors we see in nature, they are indeed due to the coupling of the electrical field component to materials. So what is done here, actually, a family of six different pairs of metal strips, you're placed on the same glass substrate. And so here you could see the widths of the strips varying between 95 to 170 nanometers. And depending on the widths of the strips, the frequency at which this coupling to the magnetic field component occurs also changes. And when you irradiate it with white light, those frequency component which couple to these magnetic structures get absorbed, and that results in these beautiful colors, both in transmittance and reflectance. And although there is, of course, also electrical resonance, but it tends to be shifted to the blue and the UV part of the spectrum, so it doesn't contribute much to these colors. So these colors are largely due to the coupling to the magnetic field component. So we call it metamagnetic with rainbow colors. Here is actually the result when we magnetic permeability which we obtain in these artificial structures. So by varying the widths of these strips between 50 to 120 nanometers, you actually can get resonance at any wavelength in the visible part of the spectrum, from red one, 750, to the blue one, 475 or so. And the magnetic permeability, again, let me remind you that for all materials in nature, magnetic permeability is extremely close to one, the same as in vacuum. Here we obtain mu, which varies between 0.5 down to minus 1.7. And so basically now we can create artificial magnetism at any wavelengths of interest in the visible part of the spectrum. That in turn enables even more wild phenomena, I mean this artificial magnetism, specifically negative refractive index. And again, at least as of now, nobody obtained materials in nature which would have negative refractive index, although we have to be careful by saying that it doesn't exist in nature. I guess we should be humbled in front of Mother Nature. But, so we certainly can create it now artificially in the lab. So refractive index related to this basic parameters, epsilon, the electric permittivity, which characterizes coupling to the electrical field component, and mu, magnetic permeability, which tells how strong is coupling to the magnetic field component, through this simple relation which follows from the Maxwell's equations. And normally, for most of materials, both epsilon and mu are positive, and therefore refractive indexes are positive as well. But it turns out that under certain conditions, refractive index can be negative, and that condition, as can be proven mathematically, results in this necessary condition for having refractive index negative. So that's it's written here, where prime stands for the real part. And let me first emphasize the importance of magnetism. Again, for the optical range, mu is simply equal 1. The real part is equal 1, as in vacuum, and no imaginary part. And this inequality becomes epsilon prime plus modulus epsilon smaller than 0. And that's impossible because modulus, or the magnitude, is always larger than the real part. That means that without artificial magnetism, you cannot have refractive index negative, which emphasizes the importance of creating this artificial magnetism, because as the second step, you can realize this highly unusual situation when refractive index is negative. So what it happens when refractive index negative, the very basic things, such as, for example, refraction at the interface between two materials, normally when both materials have positive refractive index, let's say air and water, light would get reflected and refracted. So, and the refracted beam would go this side with respect to the normal. If refractive index is negative, however, then the Snell's law requires that the beam should go this side with respect to the normal. And that's already highly unusual. I mean, many things would look entirely different, like looking through water, many other things. It's the whole world would look differently if refractive index would switch from positive to negative values. But even more striking thing that for normal materials, of course, phase propagates in the same direction as the energy, as you could see it here. If refractive index is negative, and refractive index actually characterizes the phase velocity of light, it means that the phase propagates against the flow of energy. And that's highly, highly unusual thing, which results in many interesting applications, including, for example, such thing as a superlens, which I mentioned later. So here I'm showing actually the history of this race in terms of obtaining negative refractive index in the optical range. Turns out that our group in Purdue and Steve Brooks' group at the University of New Mexico in collaboration with Columbia University did it really nearly simultaneously. We placed it like 2-3 weeks earlier on archive, our result, but their paper was slightly earlier published than others. So we decided basically that simultaneously and independently, and we all agree in the group. So we did it. They did it for 2 microns. We showed it for 1.5 micron. And of course, then the race continued. The Karlsruhe group, which I already mentioned, obtained a number of beautiful results in this area, and they were first to bring it to the visible part of the spectrum. 780 nanometers is officially the boundary with the visible part of the spectrum. But most recent results, we again now keep the record in terms of the shortest wavelength at which the negative refractive index has been obtained. In fact, Shumin claims now that she has a material with 500, my student Shumin Shao, that she has a material with negative refractive index at 560 nanometers. So we're still verifying those results. Well, and the structure to obtain this negative refractive index, which we use, actually consists of pairs of these strips, which provide this magnetic response, which I was talking about. And it turns out if you add perpendicularly pairs of other strips, that would provide negative epsilon, because it acts like kind of diluted metal. And the resultant structure, which people call now a fishnet, because it looks like a fishnet, that's the structure which provides this negative refractive index. And this is our most recent accomplishment, which was published in this MRS bulletin. So where we show the structures which go with have this negative refractive index down to 710 nanometers, which is red light. Metamaterials is a fascinating field, of course, and there are still lots of problems like losses and many other which we are working on. But it turns out that they open even more exciting field. The field which people loosely call now the transformation optics, and perhaps could go beyond of even the wildest imagination. Certainly, it did go beyond what I could expect a few years ago when first I asked my student in Shanghai to think of optical clocking. And his reaction was, "Are you crazy, professor?" So it's fascinating, and that actually things here get really wild. And there are different ways to think of this transformation optics. And perhaps the best one, at least in my opinion, the most intuitive one is based on the Fermat principle. And the Fermat principle, which in turn follows from so-called Montpellier principle, controlling propagation of any object, actually. So when it applies to light, then it becomes this famous Fermat principle. And it tells us that the optical path, which is given by the product of refractive index and geometrical path, should be minimized when light propagates through a material. And that's exactly the path which light chooses so that this optical path is minimized. And normally when refractive index is constant, that implies that light propagates along a straight line. However, refractive index, as we know now, is a function of dielectric permittivity and magnetic permeability. And we actually could engineer that, design and engineer on nanoscale. In principle, we could fabricate any distribution of refractive index. Of course, the challenges here are huge, but in principle, it's possible. And then to optimize optical path, light would propagate along very curved geometrical line. So it could be actually almost like nearly anything. We could create area where light cannot enter at all. So that would be kind of forbidden area, and that's the idea behind clocking. Then you wouldn't be able to see certain part of space if light cannot enter there. Or you could do the opposite thing. You could concentrate light in some part of space up to extremely large values. That would work like light concentrator or optical black hole, if you wish. And all these things turn out to be possible to do on an optical table. I should say that the mathematics behind it is very much similar to what we have for the gravitation theory. When if mass is huge, then both space and time are curved, but you cannot control it. You cannot make any experiment. Here you could do that. You could actually mimic and obtain all this exotic behavior for light, which is predicted, for example, in the gravitation theory for gravitation waves. So that's the idea behind clocking, which we suggested in 2007, and for microwave range, the idea was proposed by other people, and Sir John Penry played a critical role, and the Duke's group, led by David Smith,
actually made first experimental realization for the microwave range. But that approach would not work for the visible part of the spectrum for a variety of reasons. And of course, invisibility itself is defined for the visible part of the spectrum. So we had to come with idea how to do it in the visible part of the spectrum. And so the idea is actually was suggested by my critical student, Wenxuan Cai, who now moved to Stanford. And he actually came up with this specific design, which now became quite famous. So it's if you take a cylindrical shell like this, and made of some transparent material, such as glass, let's say, and if you incorporate these metal needles inside of this material so that it looked like round hairbrush, like it's depicted here, then what happens that metal has extremely large and negative value of epsilon, so that even if you put very little amount of metal, because it has very large and negative epsilon, the effective epsilon for this combined material, meaning the electric host and metal, could become zero just even at very low concentration of metal. Typically, if you have, let's say, metal filling factor 10% or even less sometimes, you could have the effective dielectric permittivity here zero, meaning that in this particular case, refractive index is zero because we don't involve here any magnetism, which makes it much simpler to accomplish. And then epsilon gradually increases from zero to one. It's zero at the inner cylinder and one at the outer cylinder. That means that the refractive index changes from zero here at the inner cylinder to one at the outer cylinder. That's exactly why light actually bends around this clock, because of this refractive index varying from zero to one in a very similar fashion as water flows around a stone. And it doesn't penetrate inside of this cylinder, so that whatever you place there would be invisible. And most importantly, light is not perturbed because it kind of flows around in a nice way without scattering, at least under ideal conditions. Almost done. So, and here you see the results of our simulation. When you don't have this clock, of course, light gets scattered and this shadow is cast. When you turn on your clock, then actually you see light bends around. If whatever would be in the background, light would get reflected from that and come back to the observer. So the observer would not have any clue, ideally, what is located here, because ideally, as I said, there is no any scattering, and he would be able to see what is behind the clock. So that the illusion is that basically whatever is here is completely evaporated, like doesn't exist. We actually now working on something which mimics this phenomenon. It's not exactly the clock we proposed, but it looks like it mimics very precisely this idea. And I'm not in a position yet to claim that we observed it, but we do it actually with BAE system company now. And looks like we see very, very similar phenomenon as was predicted. And to sum up, I should say that, of course, this transformation optics goes far beyond just clocking, although clocking perhaps grabs the imagination. Many other things become possible. Like Evgeny Narimanov proposed this famous hyperlens. It became quite famous, actually, which allows to see things much smaller than the wavelengths. But unfortunately, his original idea was relying on a cylindrical shape, which is not convenient for applications. And more recently, we suggested this idea of planar hyperlens, which would magnify, if you have two small spots which are located closer than the wavelengths to each other, you cannot see it with conventional microscope. But with this planar hyperlens, you could magnify it and see it in the far zone. So if you will succeed in realizing this, it could become a standard add-on tool for conventional microscopes. But then it wouldn't be limited by the diffraction, limit, and you could see, let's say, things which are much smaller than the wavelengths with a conventional microscope. It's very important. I mentioned already light concentrator. So you actually could concentrate light into extremely small spot that could be used for very efficient solar light collection. And even other exotic things, such as this optical black hole suggested recently by Evgeny and Alex Kildashev, when light is actually trapped and sucked into a certain area. So, and I guess that's it. Right, this is just a summary of what has been accomplished in our Bourque-Perdue group in this MET research area. So we were first to demonstrate a material with negative refractive index in the optical range. So we also keep the record in terms of the shortest wavelengths at which negative refractive index has been observed so far. We accomplished the demonstration of artificial magnetism across the entire visible part of the spectrum. And now we are playing with these very exciting transformation optics ideas, which enable exotic things such as a planar hyperlens, which would enable seeing things much smaller than the wavelengths, light concentrator, and clocking. So with this, let me thank you, and I stop.